Rather than have class this morning, why don't we get up and run laps? By the time we get through, we will have warmed up enough. I'm fairly certain we're selling beef out of the back room here. Glad you guys could come. We're going to be talking about the prayer of Jehoshaphat. It's in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. Can anyone tell me what the difference is between 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles? Their names? That was... We talk about the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, but these are also synoptics. Now, what makes a synoptic? Similarities. We can lay them alongside. The biggest difference between Chronicles and 1 and 2 Kings is almost without exception, the things in 1 and 2 Kings are bad. It talks primarily about the things that are wrong, the things that they did bad. Even with David, there's a great deal of time spent talking about what he did. Chronicles speaks of the good. But for me, whenever I'm studying Chronicles, it is almost a meta-narrative of the entire Bible. It contains so much of what we think about. What I mean by that, the emphasis is that there is a true God. There is the law. There is obedience. There are consequences, good and bad. Chronicles could have been written by Ezra. Truth is, we don't really know. But he was contemporary. It was written probably in the latter half of the 5th century. So Ezra could have possibly written it. Regardless, it's a story about post-exilic Judah, the southern kingdom. The name, or the Hebrew title, is really called The Events of the Day. In fact, one of the other, the Septuagint translators, call it the Book of the Things Omitted. Omitted from where? Well, it would be from Samuel and Kings. But again, it's the story about the Davidic line. But it starts before that. Chronicles starts out with genealogies. Why? Other than you get to read about the begets, what are the purpose of the genealogies? And are there differences? And if there are differences, why are there differences? And why are they important in Chronicles? I've asked enough questions where you should be able to keep talking for several minutes. Why are the genealogies important? They trace the Messiah. Okay, so we're talking about the royal line. Okay. What else? Are there differences? Are there differences in the gem? What are the differences?
Well, sometimes so-and-so begets so-and-so. It might be a father-son. It might be, next it might be a father-grandfather-son. So they skip generations occasionally, and so they're not all exactly the same.
That's really disappointing. Could you hear what Jim said? He said, so you really can't trace it father to son, because you could say somebody begets so-and-so, and it could be a grandfather and a grandson. Sometimes it went the other direction. Bishop Ussery, a Catholic bishop, wrote that we can know exactly when the beginning of Genesis was. It was in 5220-something B.C., and he did that by going back through the genealogy and assigning years. Yeah, I know. Genealogies emphasized specific things for specific themes. Okay? For instance, even where we look in Matthew, everything is done in sevens. You didn't keep up with who did, you know, who begat what. But seven was the number. I said the magic number. The number for the Jews that was so important. And so that was broken into sevens. But here, in Chronicles, it's about the Davidic line, about Judah, and the importance of the priests and the Levites. So he emphasizes the law, the priests, and the temple. Why? Who is he talking to? Who was the author writing to? Do you know? His contemporaries. These were post-exilic Jews. They were in Babylonia. So he's reminding them of their history. We are the people of God. And so he starts going all the way back, beginning with Genesis. And he carries it up through the Davidic line up to this time. One of the reasons he's writing, because at this particular time in Jewish history, they hadn't heard from a prophet in almost 100 years. Now then, there had been prophets that spoke to kings specifically. But as far as a message to the nation, that hadn't taken place. And so Ezra is going to detail why we're here, what our hope is. And he's going to talk about the relevance of all of it. It's about the relevance about the earlier Israelite history and for their particular generation. And we're going to be talking specifically today about Jehoshaphat's prayer. This is the last class in the series of prayers. What can you tell me about Jehoshaphat? What do you know about him? Say again? He was one of the good ones. How many good ones were there? You can count them on one foot, and that's if you have a missing toe. Actually, there are four that are mentioned that were in the line of David, that walked in the steps of David. Only one of those had nothing bad said about him. That was Hezekiah. Jehoshaphat was a follower of David. He followed in that line. He was that kind of a king, except he also made his own mistakes. For some history, Jehoshaphat's father was Asa, who was almost a nearly good king. All but Hezekiah, these kings that we're talking about, got this close to being good. They would almost have been able to play on Betty's team. They were close. Asa was a good king. He reformed Israel. He tore down the poles of Asherah. Those were the Canaanite fertility symbols. He did everything. He even tore down some of the high places, it said. But he did one thing wrong. The nation is attacked. He's afraid, so he sets up an alliance with a guy named Ben-Hadad. Not only does he set up an alliance, he has to pay for the alliance. To pay for the alliance, it takes treasury out of the royal treasury and from the temple. And the Lord says, because you didn't believe in me, the nation will always be at war. So Santana said, those who fail to learn from the lessons of history are doomed to repeat it. And that's George Santana, not Carlos. So his son Jehoshaphat is a good king. In fact, he starts reigning in the last 3 years of his father's reign, Asa. One of the things that happened with Asa is he had bad feet. He got a disease of the feet. It was probably more than terminal athlete's feet. In fact, it says that because he didn't pray, the Lord didn't heal him. Jehoshaphat was determined to do better. He too was a reformer. But right after he started reigning, he made an alliance with another king, Ahab. Now, if you're going on a scale of good kings to bad kings, where would you place Ahab? If we're going on a scale of 1 to 10, he's... If that's bad, I'm going to go with you, yeah. I was going to go for a 0.075. He makes an alliance with Ahab by marriage to protect Israel from an attack from the Cushites, who are the Egyptians at the time. He says, if you will come, go with me, we'll defeat these people and the Lord will be with us. And I know the Lord's going to be with us because I have consulted. This is Ahab speaking. I have consulted my 400 prophets. And they all said, you go, guy. The problem was, these guys didn't really have anything to do with the Lord. And so another prophet, Micaiah, says, if you do this, you'll lose. And Ahab said, I knew it. That guy never gives me anything but bad news. You can't trust him. And so he has him jailed. They go to war. Jehoshaphat goes to war with Ahab. They meet the Cushites. Oh, one of the interesting things that Ahab did, he said, hey, I think it would be good, just as a tactic, that you go in your royal robes representing all of Judah, and I'm going to disguise myself. Well, oddly enough, in his disguise, it says a stray arrow goes through the chinks in his armor. He's able to stay up in his chariot until he gets back to the capital. He dies in his chariot, and the prophets had said, when you die, the dogs will lick your blood from the streets. And he was married to a real winner too. Do you remember her name? How many girls do you know named Jezebel? And so Ahab comes back. He's dead from battle. Jezebel falls from the window. The dogs take care of her as well. Okay. All of that to get us to Jehoshaphat, that history. So Jehoshaphat says, I will not repeat the mistakes of my father. I'll not repeat the mistakes of Ahab. I'm going to give myself completely to the Lord. And he begins. He begins reforming the judiciary. Up at this, who maintained the law in Judah? Or even in Israel at the time? What was the court system? Do you know? It was done almost exclusively by Levitical priests. And so one of the things that Jehoshaphat did was reform and separate those two. So you had political judges who actually did rulings over civil law, and you had the Levites who did it over theological or spiritual law. He built up the temple. Remember that by now, back in Jerusalem, the temple has been rebuilt. They're worshiping there again. And so one of the things that is extremely important to Jehoshaphat is people understand the legitimacy and the importance and the power of the priesthood. Why? Who speaks to the people? Who tells them of the Lord? Who tells them the stories? The priests do. Who goes between them and God? Who represents them to God? The priests do. Shouldn't they be important? So as he's doing this, he's also tearing down idols again. You know, I talked earlier about the Asherah poles, the Canaanite fertility symbols. The problem with tearing down the idols, it says, but he didn't do anything with the high places. And we see this over and over when we're talking about the prophets and the judges even. The high places, what were they? And what importance do they have to any of this? It's where they did it. Do you think that has... Do we have idols? Give me an example, Maurice. What kind of idols do we have? Facebook is an idol? You have no idea how disappointed I am. Money. Football. Job titles. What is the most important job title in this country? Wow. And you said it's an idol. Would that make 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue a high place? Could it be? Okay. The reason that I'm stressing this, the issue that Israel and Judah had, that the kings had, that they placed their trust and their allegiance in alliances and in treaties with earthly power. Do you suppose we do the same thing? Do you suppose that we are more anxious about an election than we are about obedience? Do you suppose we spend more time thinking about who or who should not be in power than we think about who actually has power? Jehoshaphat thought so. So they get word, the people in Jerusalem, get word that they're about to be attacked by people from Moab and the Ammonites and a group called the M-E-U-I-N-I-T-E, the Meunites. Have not a clue who they are. In fact, as we read about where they came from, it says that they came from around Mount Seir. They've joined together and they're going to attack Judah. It says it is a vast army. There are thousands. When they get word, it says that they've already crossed the Dead Sea. They've come up and they're in the En-Gedi. Well, the En-Gedi is less than 25 miles southeast of Jerusalem. So the same message would be the Chinese are at Llano. Perhaps we should do something. And so this leads us up to where Jehoshaphat says he has made no alliances. The only thing we have is the Lord. And so he calls for a national day of fasting. And it says people from all over the land came to Jerusalem. And they came to the court, the great court at the temple, to pray. And so this prayer that we're about to read has some really interesting things to me. In its form, where it works literally. And as we go through it, I want you guys to tell me how you see that work out. We're reading from 2 Chronicles 20, 20 through 30. And so the prayer is a community or a national lament. It's an address to God. It's a recitation of past favors. It's a protestation of innocence and a confession of trust. It's a complaint. It's a plea for deliverance. It's a sermon. It's a sermon that is spoken to the people of Judah. And so I'm going to read by the way, that's as soon as I get my glasses right. Starting in verse 6. Lord, the God of our ancestors, are you not the God who is in heaven? You rule over all the kingdoms of the nations. Power and might are in your hand, and no one can withstand you. Our God, did you not drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it forever to the descendants of Abraham, your friend? They have lived in it and have built in it a sanctuary for your name, saying, if calamity comes upon us, whether the sword of judgment or plague or famine, we will stand in your presence before this temple that bears your name. And we will cry out to you in our distress, and you will hear us and save us. But now, here are men from Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, whose territory you would not allow Israel to invade when they came from Egypt. So they turned away from them and did not destroy them. See how they're repaying us? They're repaying us by coming to drive us out of the possession you gave us as an inheritance. Our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power to face this. That we face this vast army that's attacking us, but we do not know what to do. But our eyes are on you. Excuse me. The God of our ancestors. He talks about the covenant with Abraham, the covenant with Moses, and the covenant with David. He talks about from the beginning, you have been our God. When we've been obedient, you have been there. Haven't you been our God? Haven't you delivered us? Those are rhetorical questions. Of course he has. He already knows that. Who's he reminding? He's reminding the people. I asked earlier, do we have idols? Where do we place our power? Do you think perhaps sometimes we need reminding? That he is the God of our deliverance. Power and might are in your hand, and no one can withstand you. Our God, did you not drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it forever to the descendants of Abraham, your friend? And what was the promise to Abraham? I'll make you a mighty nation. By the way, why are there two nations? Why is there Judah in Israel? They couldn't get along with each other, and they couldn't get along with God. What was the southern kingdom? You remember? What was the southern kingdom? Judah and Benjamin. Why would this people attack the southern kingdom rather than the northern kingdom? You suppose?
The temple was there.
The temple was there. They had stuff. They had stuff worth getting. Do you suppose that they thought they were the weaker? That's one of the reasons that this took place. The reason that they came in from the southern end of the Dead Sea. They really thought Judah was a weaker. Was a weaker adversary. They've lived in it and have built it a sanctuary for your name, talking about the temple. If calamity comes upon us, whether the sword of judgment or plague or famine, where does that come from? Plague or famine? Yeah, the Mosaic covenant. And deliverance from Egypt. We will stand in your presence before this temple that bears your name, and we will cry out to you in our distress, and you will hear us and save us. About the temple, that's the Davidic covenant. Why? What does David have to do with the temple?
What
does David have to do with the temple? He didn't build it. He was trying to. He wanted to.
He probably got a bunch of money too.
Yeah, it says that he gathered everything to do it. And the Lord said, here's the covenant part. Because of the blood on your hands, and you've been a man of war, you can't. But your son will. And I will be with your line forever. The temple. But now, here are men from Ammon, Moab, and Mount Seir, whose territory you would not allow Israel to invade when they came from Egypt. So we did this good thing. We were leaving Egypt. We crossed the Red Sea. We were trying to get to Canaan. We could have gone this way. It had been a shortcut. And you said, no, don't do that. You can't go that way. So we did them a solid, and look what we get in repayment. They're coming to attack us. See how they're repaying us by coming to drive us out of the possession you gave us as an inheritance? Our God, will you not judge them? For we have no power to face this vast army that is attacking us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. One of the things that the Lord kept doing with his people was, you have to depend on me. You do not have it of yourselves. You create alliances. You've built idols. You've created things in which you've placed false hope. I'm your God. If you believe in me, I'll take care of you. Do you think it's any different now?
That's what's scary.
Why is that, Liz?
I don't think enough people in our country live and believe in him and fall on him, depend on him.
Okay. Not enough people in the country believe in, obey, and follow him. But I thought we were the promised land. Alan told me we were. Do we have, in this country, do we believe that we have some sort of divine right? You're saying yes. What does that look like? Say again. Shelda, you know, that's disappointing, because I was fairly certain that Jesus' robe had red and white stripes and a blue background with stars. Do we think that way? We say, well, of course we don't. Yeah, but what do our actions say? We say we're a godly nation. We used to say. This year, the survey came out that said for the first time since the 1950s, there are few people who believe in God than those who do. That the people who worship are fewer in number than they've ever been in this country. But the thing is, we're spiritual. We may not be communal. We may not worship in church. We may not meet with a body, but we're spiritual. Well, I've got my crystals. I've got my holy high places. Yes. Yes. Santa Fe, Sedona. Seriously. Do you think there's all that much difference in what the priests were telling people then as compared to what we're hearing here? I find it interesting that churches are being built at a faster rate in Africa than they are here. The churches are growing in Central and South America at a faster rate than they are here. So at what point do you suppose people in Rwanda and Colombia will be sending missionaries here? Yes. One of the problems that the people had, they were comfortable. Say again. They were complacent. So if I say, I can ask, do we need God? We say, yes. For what? Really? For what?
He's my peace. He's my rock. Yeah.
He's my rock, my sword, my shield. He's my wheel within a wheel. Yes. I've got a car, and I've got a house. I've got food on the table. We kind of go where we want to go.
Yeah, but that cannot be done in a heartbeat.
Okay.
All it takes is one good storm. I mean, my peace does not come in what I have.
Okay. I agree. Own stuff. Okay. But don't you like it? We like to talk about this generation. Where did they learn it? You know, the single most important decision you'll ever make in your life, you can write this down. The single most important decision you'll ever make in your life is choosing your parents. That will affect your finances. It will affect your personality. It will affect your education. The point in all of this, what Becky said is right. That's absolutely right. But it's what we do, not what we say. I said, do we need God? And everybody says, But living like that's an entirely different thing. What does that look like to us? And what if I say that doesn't involve necessarily just being here? The temple was important.
It's daily life.
It's the daily life. That's exactly it. It's what Bruce said in the communion talk. Which are we, a Samaritan, the priest, the Levite? It's what Kyle talked about in his exhortation. It's how we see people. We're called to be the hands and feet. Well, what does that look like? Our God, will you not judge them, for we have no power to face this vast army that is attacking us. We do not know what to do, but our eyes are on you. And what Jim said a bit ago was, it's against powers and principalities that we're at war. And because things are good, it's hard to remember how incredibly important it is for us to be with God. And it's our service to one another that shows whether we are or we're not. And how will they know you're mine? When I was in prison, you visited me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. It is how we serve, not what we say. Yes, ma'am. Could you hear what Carrie said? She said, so in other countries, they need God. You see, we're comfortable. We have what we need as far as basic things go. They don't. What they have is God. We study God. They worship God. Was that close? I think one of the things that happened with the people in Israel and Judah, so much of the law became an intellectual conceit. Do you know what I mean by that? It is about what we know. I'm fairly certain if Christianity comes down to a multiple choice test, man, we're golden. Well, what'd you do with it? It's not what we know, it's who we know. And Jehoshaphat said, we can't do this. It's up to you. And he fell to his knees, and the people did also, and it said, and they became prostrate. Flat on the ground. Do you think that sometimes we forget We are to humble ourselves before the Lord. And what does that look like? What does that mean to us? When is the last time you prayed so deeply from your soul that the words didn't come? You knew there was a prayer going out, but you couldn't articulate it. Have you ever been there? What's the most frightened you've ever been in your life? When have you hurt the most? When have you ever felt so lonely that you had no idea where help would come from? And that's when the Spirit speaks for us. And that's where Jehoshaphat was. He finishes his prayer. He's on his face. He gets up. And a prophet named Jehaziel comes in and he says, "The Lord is with you. We will win. Tomorrow there will be an incredible victory. And you don't have to do anything." Nothing. And it says, and the next morning they gathered up, and the army gathered up, and the priest came and led a prayer. And then they started singing. Somebody turn to Psalms 136, 1, please. What does it say? Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. Do you remember what Chris was doing this morning? He did a reading, and there was a response. That's what this is. It's a song. You give a reading, and there was a response. And the army marched out singing. They get to a place called Tekoa. The desert of Tekoa, the valley of Barakah. And there are some lookouts up above the valley. They're sandstone cliffs. And so one of the scouts is up there, and he looks back and he says, "Here come the guys." And he said, "Yeah, well, they're all dead." "What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, they're all dead. These thousands and thousands that came are all dead." It looks like one group suspected the other group, and so they attacked them, and they killed them. And then that group started looking at each other and said, "Yeah, well, I don't know about you either." And they killed each other. And they came, and the army from Judah marches into the valley, and they rejoice, and they start carrying stuff back to Jerusalem. And it took them 4 days to carry all the booty and the plunder back to Jerusalem. The important part. And they took the spoils back to the temple. So this was never about Judah's war. It was never about Jehoshaphat's war. It was God's war. And the Lord said, "Be still and know that I am God." And the Lord says, "Be still and know that I'm God." I am always faithful. When you're not, I'm always faithful. Because I cannot deny myself. That's our God. That's our lesson. Y'all, thank you so very much. I appreciate it.